This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And today we're going to begin our show with Joy Ryan. Joy is the president and CEO of the North Dakota Boys and Girls Ranches, located in Bismarck and Minot and Fargo. And today she joins us from her office in South Fargo. Joy, thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's get a little history first for our listeners. How did the ranch get its start?
In 1952, outside of Mapleton, North Dakota, there was a small Lutheran congregation. The auxiliary of that congregation started to become concerned about the number of young boys who were really being asked to help support families. If you think about the timing of this, it's not very long after World War II. Of course, we lost about 1,700 North Dakotans in World War II, most of them men. And so there were a lot of families that were still adjusting to that reality. And there were boys being asked to work as agricultural laborers or to go make it on their own in the big cities of Fargo or Grand Forks. And this little Lutheran group thought that maybe that was too early for some of the kids who were 9, 10, 11 years old. They started to recruit what they called host families, what we would probably now traditionally call foster families, to allow these children to move into their homes and become part of their families. That was the beginning of the ranch. There were families across the state of North Dakota who accepted these young boys. But there was one family in particular up in Tully, North Dakota, north of Minot, just off the Canadian border, Ida May and Louis Butt. The Butts had a 940-acre ranch. They did not have children of their own, and they had room for what they figured would be appropriate for 6 boys. So they opened their home and their hearts, and they welcomed 6 of these boys into their home. And then they added on, closed off a lean-to on the house and were able to house 8, and then built on again and were able to house 10. The boys at that point were still going to public school, so they were going to the Tully School District, and that was a little overwhelming for the Tully School District. And after lots of conversations and guidance by what was then had then been established as a delegate board of directors, the Butts donated their ranch, and the sale of the ranch was used to purchase land outside of Minot, North Dakota, where our primary campus still is.
So Minot, Bismarck, and Fargo, you've grown in those, almost 70 years. How many kids do you serve now?
On a daily basis, in, if I can use air quotes, normal times, we have about 140 kids on our campuses on a daily basis, not only resident children, but also day students who come in for education at our on-campus school, Dakota Memorial School.
And how do these boys and girls come to you?
They come a lot of different ways. All of the kids that we serve are at-risk youth. The day students that come to us that live within their home settings and then come to us for school are referred by their home school districts because those school districts are not able to meet the high needs of the children. We serve kids who have behavioral, psychiatric, and trauma response issues. So like I said, the day students come referred by their home school districts. The other children that come to us for either foster care or psychiatric care, one of our areas of service is we provide the highest level of adolescent and child psychiatric residential care outside of a psychiatric hospital. The children that are in either of those programs may come from a family referral. They may be self-placed. They may come through child protective services. They may come through a medical provider's referral, or we do have about 20% of our kids come through the juvenile justice system.
So are some of these kids traumatized when they arrive? Are they people that need to work through some issues that put them where they are?
Yes, 100% of our kids have some type of trauma experience. Even those kids that maybe started with a differential kind of diagnosis, like maybe they're on the autism spectrum or have other concerns like that, generally have, as a result of those issues, also experienced trauma of bullying, trauma of abuse, because they just don't get it. We treat every child as a trauma survivor.
So many of these young people you serve would have had difficulty, perhaps great difficulty, in school. How do you deal with that challenge?
We have what is called a trauma-sensitive and trauma-informed learning environment within our school, Dakota Memorial School. It is one part of our service delivery that people don't always know about. But Dakota Memorial School, we serve kids on the Minot campus in elementary school down to second grade, and on all our campuses, seventh through graduation. The teachers that we employ, we train all of them in trauma-informed sensitivity teaching practices. Every child has a individualized and personalized approach to their learning. Our kids are able to learn. We have children who have participated in the Microsoft coding days and those types of things, and children from our school have taken like second place in the competitions. These are smart kids, but they need to be met where they're at. And because of the trauma they've experienced, many are hypervigilant. They're easily distracted. They have trouble staying in one place for a long time. So we create learning environments that allow them to stay in the classroom and yet move around and still learn. It's a lot of understanding where the child is at and meeting them there, earning their trust, teaching them that we're in this for them. It takes a lot. Some of our kids are sex traffic survivors. Some of our kids are abuse and neglect victims. Some of our kids, they've seen things that you or I should never even consider happening in the world. It takes a lot to earn their trust, but that's where it starts.
Joy Ryan is president and CEO of the North Dakota Boys and Girls Ranch. Joy, you mentioned that you have residential and day students. How long would a residential student maybe have to stay? If you're dealing with them from 7th through 12th grade, would you have them for 5 years?
Oh, no, no. In our psychiatric care programs, the children will be with us maybe from 5 to 7 months, until they're able to step down to a lower level of care. And that's called psychiatric residential treatment facility care. The second level of care changed under a federal law as of October of last year, and it's called qualified residential treatment programs. And that is a treatment level of care within the foster care world. And those kids may stay longer. They have more behavioral issues. They may have more challenges with living in a family household. So they may be with us a year on average. Our goal is always to have them move on to a lower level of care. That's our job, is to get them to a place where they can function without us.
You're in the helping business, and obviously there's a lot of compassion and concern that's involved with that kind of relationship with a student. But are there some you cannot help?
Yes, there are always some that maybe because the care wasn't offered early enough in their journey, their survival skills, because really the behaviors that we see are very often developed so that these children can survive. That's why I always say the kids are our heroes. And so if every time you walk in my room, you're going to hurt me, I'm going to either find a way to separate myself from what's happening to my body, or I'm going to learn to fight back, or I'm going to learn to swear, I'm going to become violent, I'm going to become many of the things that we see from children are survival skills. And that's why trust is so critical, as well as the psychiatric. We have our own psychiatrists, nurse practitioners. We have a nursing staff of almost 20. People sometimes don't realize the level of medical care that's provided at the ranch. But some kids come to us with brains that have developed behaviors that are so entrenched that they're beyond what our ability is to help them. And those are tragic.
Well, how has the pandemic changed business as usual for the Boys and Girls Ranch?
Oh, it's been fascinating. We live in unsettled times, right? As far as the children who are living at the ranch, the greatest challenge has been that the work that we do with them to kind of normalize their lives, taking them into the community, teaching them social skills, doing all of those things, obviously have been abruptly ended. And so for children that have sensory issues, that have behavioral issues, it's really hard to feel that level of constriction. But we have supplemented our work by doing more on-campus outdoor activities, art activities, all of those types of things. We had to restrict visits from outside folks for a while. We are now allowing visits from family, but it was hard at the beginning when we had to keep those things very restricted. Of course, we're doing the same things that many people are doing. We're doing the healthcare check-ins. We're monitoring the kids' health on a daily basis. All of those pieces to keep our kids safe. The two biggest changes probably are within our school because of the pressures on the teachers that teach our kids and having their kids home from school and everything else. We did go to a distance learning format, so we're providing distance learning even for the kids that are on campus as well as our day students. And that's been a strain on us technology-wise, but it's gone better than I would have anticipated. And we have kids ready to graduate this year, and we're very proud of them. The other side of it is that we rely on our thrift stores to underwrite a great deal of our programming that isn't covered by any insurance or any kind of funding stream. Our work with our horses, our trauma-sensitive elements of our education, the additional services there, our sensory rooms, spiritual life programming, all of those types of things are supported outside of the normal funding streams through our thrift stores and through donors. We have a chain of 9 thrift stores. Everybody knows the ranch thrift stores.
Yes.
And of course, they were closed for a month. That was very hard on the staff of the thrift stores and very hard on us financially. We reopened with partial hours starting Monday. We're doing our best to keep everybody healthy in those situations, but that was a very big blow to us and to that part of our work.
How many people do you employ?
System-wide, we have 3 corporations, and across those 3 corporations, about 540 to 560 on a daily basis.
That's quite a ratio considering you've got fewer than 200 kids involved in the program.
Yeah, but it's 24/7, 365, and it's 9 stores and 4 warehouses and an outpatient clinic that sees another couple thousand people on an ongoing basis. It's a fully functioning school. It's a fully functioning psychiatric center. It's a fully functioning clinic. There's a lot of pieces to it, and the kids that live with us are only part of it.
The school is easy to find online. It's the North Dakota Boys and Girls Ranch. And Joy, I went up there and looked at your website, and there's a lot of information there. You referenced one element that I found intriguing, equine-assisted therapy. You also have this National Youth Project Using Mini Bikes program. I think that's at Minot. Can you describe how these programs help in the kind of therapy that you're dealing with these kids with?
Absolutely. We have equine-assisted therapy on all 3 campuses. On the Minot campuses, the horses are our staff. They're with us. We have a herd of 23 horses, many of them geriatric, I will tell you that.
Peaceful.
Yes, I think we have, I think of the 23, something like 16 or 17 are over 25 years old, beautifully cared for. And the work with the horses is phenomenal to watch. The children, as I've said, have a lot of trust issues, and they've earned the right to have those trust issues. Sometimes working with these large patient creatures, they start out by brushing them and teaching them how to groom them, and then learn perhaps how to sit on them or ride them, guide them. We train the horses for 2 years before we let them near a child. They are able to connect calmly and quietly with a child. The movement of a horse when you're on a horse is as close to walking, and there's matchings with the heartbeats. There's all kinds of pieces to being on a horse that are calming and soothing to a child. So then very often what happens is the child starts to talk to the horse. The therapist is with them. The child will share, just like you or I used to share with our dog or our cat or whatever, what's on their heart and what's in their mind. And the therapist is there to talk them through it, work through it. Very often the first staff that the children trust is their horse. On the Bismarck and Fargo campuses, we work with local stables that have trained horses so that all the children have the opportunity for that type of therapy. In Bismarck, we work with Harmony, and here in Fargo, we work with Jubilee Stables. So it's a pretty important part of what we do, and it isn't unusual for a child that has been with us to come back and visit their horse.
What about the mini bike program in Minot? How does that work?
Yeah, it's in Minot and in Bismarck, and it's called NIPM, the National Youth Program Using Mini Bikes. It's a effort by the Honda Corporation to teach children. It's actually a responsibility program. So it starts with classroom learning about safety and responsibility, and the children earn each step of the way the right to move one step further and one step further until they're able to work on the bikes, maybe change oil on the bikes, care for the bikes, and then eventually ride. And so they'll ride in training courses to start with, and then when they reach a certain competency level, they may go on a trail ride with the supervisors of the programs. But it really teaches them about accountability, responsibility, and all of those pieces. This year, right now, Honda has asked us to keep it to the classroom level until later in the summer. So the kids are working in the classroom right now, getting their points and I's dotted and T's crossed before they get on the bikes. We found it to be especially popular with our girls. You know, our girls tend to think of themselves as a little bit different, and, you know, riding a mini bike is cool. So.
Well, is the North Dakota Boys and Girls Ranch system big enough to serve the need?
It's an interesting question. I think we still are challenged to recognize mental health issues, psychiatric issues, behavioral health issues. I don't think people find help soon enough. I think we're hesitant. If our child has a broken leg, we take them to the doctor immediately. But if our child is struggling with other behavioral issues, we may think, well, it's something they're going to grow out of, or they didn't used to be like that. So sometimes I wonder how big the need is, and that's a challenge. There are additional colleagues in the state who provide some of the services that the ranch provides, and I think North Dakota, by and large, is very attentive to our children. By and large, North Dakota cares very much about how our kids are educated and how they grow up. It is interesting to note, though, you know, we live in a different time. Our kids that are with us today, although they're all North Dakotans, were born in 22 different states and two foreign countries. We live in a very mobile society, so we all come from somewhere, I guess.
Over the course of almost 70 years, there must be some wonderful success stories about kids who've been transformed by the experience and gone on to fulfilling lives.
Oh, there certainly are. You know, I had been here a very short period of time, maybe less than 2 weeks. A gentleman called from Canada, and he said, I just wanted to tell you my story. And I said, okay. He said, I was one of the first boys to live on the Tully farm. And he said, I'm getting to the point in my life where I wanted someone to know that I did really good, and I lived a really good life. And he had gone on to be an engineer in the Marines, had married a Canadian woman, had lived in Canada and practiced as an engineer all his life. We have a gentleman here in Fargo who has very publicly shared his time here at the ranch and now is a police officer with the Fargo Police Department and comes and visits the kids here on campus fairly often. We had a young lady speak to one of our groups this spring. It seems so long ago, but this spring she was with us dealing with addiction, abuse, all types of trauma in her life, and she has gone on to have her master's degree in water recovery engineering and is now living in Colorado and doing that. Some of our kids grow up to be really good moms and dads, and considering they may not have had that experience themselves, I see that as much success as running your own business, I guess.
Joy Ryan is president and CEO of the North Dakota Boys and Girls Ranch. Joy, thank you for spending time with us today.
It's an absolute delight. Thank you for your interest in the children of North Dakota and in the ranch.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Benedictine Health System, helping seniors live fully with independent housing, assisted living, long-term care, and rehab services in North Dakota and Minnesota. BHSHealth.org.
I'm Eric Dethridge for Prairie Public. You may have noticed on our website and social media feeds that we have been asking people, what's the first place you'll go when it's time to go out and eat again?
My name is Dana. I live in Sharon, North Dakota. And each morning, about 5 o'clock, I drive 9 miles to Findlay, North Dakota, to a little cafe called the Dakota Cafe. And a group of about 8 to 12 retired people from the community meet there for coffee and some breakfasts. And it's kind of loosey-goosey, but nice service, and we serve ourselves. And for a dollar, you can drink about 25 cups of coffee. And it's fun this time of year because the snowbirds are coming back and there'll be many fresh stories to talk about. And right now, farmers are talking about the price of commodities, the weather, and then at the end they always say, and then there'll be next year. And that's about all I have to say. It's a nice little cafe in Findlay, North Dakota.
Well, Dana, thank you for that. And hey, we'd like to know, where's the first place you'll go when you feel the time is right? Let us know at prairiepublic.org, and we will enter you into a drawing for a gift card to your favorite restaurant, tavern, or coffee shop. The first place I'll go on Prairie Public is sponsored in part by Bremer Bank.
Coming up on Main Street, regional poet Natalie Pierce will share a new poem and the inspiration behind it. And Watford City science teacher Amy Polivka will talk about distance education. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota's Department of Transportation opened to the public on Monday. It's by appointment only, and the DOT sites have been very busy.
On Monday, we took in an extremely high volume of calls for driver's license and motor vehicle, and we're just working through that right now by scheduling appointments and getting people in as quick as we can.
DOT's Driver's License Division Director Brad Schaefer.
So you can call the number that we have on our website, and if you can't get through to the driver's license side because of the high volumes, we have also made a feature available on our website where you can request an online appointment. And then we will have somebody that will call you back and schedule something with you as soon as we can.
Schaefer says DOT is not offering all services.
What we're offering are all our CDL activity. We're also doing all of the road tests, the Class D road tests now. And we're also doing the Class D knowledge tests, you know, especially for the kids out there that are anxious to get going. So those have been very popular. We're also doing out-of-state transfers for people that need to want to vote here really soon. So we're taking care of all those people. And then we're also going to be doing motorcycle knowledge tests.
Schaefer says when you come to a DOT site, your temperature will be checked and you will be asked some questions about your health and potential exposure to the coronavirus. COVID-19 has had a profound effect on North Dakota's bar, restaurant, and liquor store purchases during March when the effects of the pandemic were beginning to take hold. State Tax Commissioner Ryan Rauschenberger.
Bars were down about 37% in March 2020 compared to March 2019 in liquor sales, and restaurants were down 48%, so they were down about half from the year before.
Rauschenberger says the impacts were felt even before Governor Burgum temporarily banned on-site customers.
I was having conversations with a number of the owners of these establishments, and they were already starting to see their busiest nights only half, maybe two-thirds full, when they would normally have people, you know, waiting in line to get in. So there was a slide in activity in bars and restaurants well before the governor had to do the mandatory shutdown.
Meanwhile, North Dakota liquor store sales soared during March. Rauschenberger says off-sale liquor purchases jumped nearly 30% when compared to March of 2019. And the state health department is confirming two additional COVID-19 deaths in North Dakota, raising the statewide death toll to 40. The patients were both women in their 90s from Cass County with underlying health conditions. Out of the 1,113 individuals tested for the novel coronavirus yesterday, 76 tested positive. The positive percentage rate has risen above 6% for the second day in a row. Today's rate is 6.8%. 1,647 people have tested positive overall. 69 of the new cases were from Cass County, 4 were from Grand Forks County. Burley, Morton, and Ward counties each report one new case. 37 people are currently hospitalized, with 127 people being hospitalized overall. There have been 969 recoveries. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. A couple of weeks ago, our director of radio, Bill Thomas, suggested that we ask poets to submit pieces that reflect on our current situation. We are all living through something very unusual. One of the first responses to Bill's request was this.
It started out as I wanted to send some letters to family and friends to connect during this time of social distancing. It's always so much fun to get something in the mail besides bills and junk mail. Also, I'm part of a snail mail group, and I was really behind on my letter writing. The first line was a pretty logical opening, just a note to send some cheer. I usually start out my day by reading some poetry, and I think that day I had been reading Keats or one of the hardcore rhyme and meter masters, so I was in that frame of mind, and the second line just tacked itself on with a rhyme, from far away to you right here. That sounded like such a smart coupling. I felt like I couldn't just leave that hanging there, like it needed a whole poem after it. Plus, most of my poems are prose poems. Rhyme and meter are completely secondary to the thought I'm trying to express. So for a while, I'd been thinking, okay, seriously, one of these days I need to just get to it and write a poem that rhymes, because they're fun to read. That first couplet was bound so tight together that it set a rhythm for the rest of the lines. So I stuck with that form, just adding couplets. I started out with lighter material, adding the parts about being stuck at home and how it's not so bad. Then some of the themes I've been working on in my other poetry, some deeper thoughts, started working their way into the lines. Just a note to send some cheer from far away to you right here. Although the days may look the same, each set inside a homebound frame. Move quieter and you'll awake the clearer tones each difference takes. Inside the stillness you will find our hearts all climb on the same vine. And while we breathe and while we see, though distant in our geography, the misty ends of all we hope still harmonize in one soul note. Whatever troubles you've been weaving, drop them without grieving. You will come again to face the gale, to know your mettle and to prevail. Until then, let ambitions rest, the barmaid's laugh, the weekend guest. The clouds will pass, the weather change, and what was calm will rearrange. So hold fast still to your small shoot, sip wisdom flowing from the root. The buds will shiver off the dew and open to the sun anew. The pace of our lives is so frenetic. There's so much noise in our world and so many things constantly asking for our attention. I think it's easy to be distracted from things that really matter. So when people hear this poem, I hope the poem can create a space where all that noise goes away and the listener can find out what they notice or hear inside that space. Also, lately, I'm focused on this idea of the oneness of everything, that we all draw from the same pool of energy and we're all connected within it. you can look at the macrocosm of the universe, and you can look at the microcosm of what's inside an atom, and you can look just as far in either direction. At this moment in time with the pandemic, we're kind of being denied one of those options to get out and explore and move bigger. But I hope this poem will help people remember that there's this microcosm of your internal spirit that if you travel deep enough into, allows you to connect to other people in a sense by coming to understand that universal force better. So I hope this poem helps people feel connected to others, even though they may be physically distant right now.
That was Natalie Pierce. If you are a poet or have something that you think is appropriate for our current time, contact Bill Thomas. His email address is bthomas@prairiepublic.org. Next on Main Street, a Watford City science teacher talks about coping with the sudden move to distance education.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. North Dakota United produces the Education Mindset podcast with host Tom Gerhardt. Today we'd like to share an excerpt that features Watford City science teacher Amy Polivka. Amy is also the president of her local education association. Here's Tom and Amy in a discussion about how the pandemic forced schools to quickly adapt to distance education classes.
Let's go back to the beginning of this pandemic. It seems like a couple of years ago instead of several weeks ago, but can you just kind of walk me through how quickly things changed and what you experienced during that time?
Yeah, I guess personally, we had heard the stories in the news and the elevation of schools closing and higher ed establishments closing, the cancellation of sports, and it just seemed really surreal, and it felt like, oh, it'll be a while yet before it hits us. And then we went home for a weekend and didn't come back. And I think that was definitely an eye-opener to us, a wake-up call. Couple of days without school, and then we all started thinking, what's next? What do we need to do? And how are we going to finish up the school year? So it was kind of a shock and awe feeling, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Can you take me through that process once you sort of got your feet back underneath you and your fellow educators did as well and started to process, this is going to be the way things are for a while. We have to figure out a way to move forward. What did you all do?
Yeah, I guess it was obviously initiated by our administration that we were going to report that Wednesday. So we had Monday and Tuesday of no reporting. It was also the week that we were starting our parent-teacher conferences. So that was looming in everybody's mind. How are we going to carry out parent-teacher conferences? How are we going to start building online lessons or distance learning, and really what was the definition of those two things and what's the difference between those two things. And so, you know, our administration initiated it, and then on that Tuesday, they brought in some teacher leaders as well, and we met and kind of discussed what we felt would be best for our community. Again, a community that's been impacted by oil and a lot of people from diverse areas of the country, and the thought of how are they going to navigate this, schooling their kids at home and continuing to work. Because at that time, we really did not foresee a lot of the oil field companies slowing down at that time. So that was kind of our biggest concern. And then again, parent-teacher conferences, making those contacts and trying to communicate to our parents and our kids what these changes would be and what that would mean for them and their education. I think the biggest concern we had was regression as well. You know, how do we keep our kids from moving backwards and keep them moving forward so that when we do resume school, we can kind of go back to normal without having to do a lot of remedial education as well.
You mentioned the diversity in Watford City, and it just got me thinking, when you have people from a number of countries speaking a number of different languages in a community like Watford City. That does present a unique challenge as well. Mm-hmm. How has that been tackled?
Yes, I do truly believe our EL population is probably struggling the most with this transition to e-learning, mostly because they, you know, rely so much on face-to-face communication to learn the language and understand the language. So when that's not available, I think it becomes much more difficult for them. However, we are super fortunate that we were set up one-to-one, at least at the high school and the middle school, with Chromebooks, and they have the Google Translate function. We as teachers have that and use that. So through those tools, I feel like they are able to do some work, but definitely not understand and learn at the same level that they were. Our EL staff has been amazing. Our translator for the district is working around the clock to make those communications for us. And you know, we put everything that we want the parents to know in an email, and she seems to get that across. It's just the getting the work back and getting them in for those services and that help that's been a challenge right now.
You mentioned the administration and the lead that they've taken, I'm sure, as in every district. How about the Watford City Education Association in your role as president? What have you all been able to do, and how have you communicated and kept things going?
Yeah, I think we have pretty open communication with our admin. I, of course, you know, seem to get a lot of phone calls from teachers with concerns or, you know, worries, I think, from their own family situation to the educational situation, to contracts, declining enrollment, increasing enrollment, all of those questions came up. So I just fielded a lot of phone calls from our members and then went on to our administration. Dr. Holen was really open to having us come and share our opinions. And so on that Tuesday, you know, when they brought in the teacher leads, I felt like we had a voice. They listened to us and they worked with us. And when we went to work that Wednesday to get our PD and move forward, a lot of people had their concerns settled before we came in. So we were able to get to work. That doesn't mean concerns don't still arise. Those things are happening weekly. But I think we've communicated as a unified front that this is an ever-changing model of education. Next week's going to look different than this week, and we just have to be able to adjust to fit the needs of our teachers and our educators. So it's not perfect, but we're working on getting there.
Well, I introduced you as a science teacher at the high school level in Watford City. You mentioned that a lot of your life now is spent on Zoom or something, Microsoft Teams or something like that, like a lot of us.
Yes.
Tell me what it's like being a science teacher during a pandemic.
It's challenging because I love teaching hands-on. This is the point in the year where I do a ton of hands-on lab-based experiments to teach the concepts that we've been working towards in physics and physical science. And so I really had to turn to a lot of online resources, like you said, Zoom, Google Meet, Google Hangouts. All of those have helped. I've also spent a lot of time, you know, scouring the internet for interactives that are online that are easy for kids to understand and use, making videos, teaching them how to do that, how to use it. And that kind of stuff. So it's really kind of broadened my resources as a teacher. It's given me the time and the place to dig for some of those resources. But I absolutely miss the hands-on stuff. One of my videos, I just demonstrated a lab and did the lab for the kids because I felt like it was that valuable. I just couldn't find anything that I wanted to replace for it. And so I think that's important. But We're definitely learning to use some resources that maybe weren't commonplace before the pandemic.
Is it true? I've read a lot just scanning social media and things that a lot of educators are putting in more time now than before, whether that's because it's, you know, maybe some things like waiting in Zoom for your students to get in touch maybe isn't quite as efficient as being in a classroom. But do you think that's true overall?
Yeah, I do think we're spending probably the same amount of time, if not more. It's just time spent differently right now. I think I do spend a lot of time in Zoom hoping kids will come to me. That's not the reality. I think now after the first 4 weeks, I've realized that I have to seek those kids out and ask them, invite them to come to Zoom and help out with the learning experience and kind of participate that way. But I don't know if that's any different than at school, because motivation and time management is always a concern with high school students. So I always feel like I'm pestering them to do the right thing when it comes to their educational choices. I think lesson development, though, definitely we are spending way more time on lesson development. As a teacher that's been in the trade for 15 years, I can walk in the classroom and, you know, kind of do what I do every day and not have to think about all the logistics of it because it comes as a second nature to me. I can't imagine being a first year, second year teacher right now and navigating this. Mm. I also think we have teachers that have been in the field for a long time and that have not touched technology as much as a person like myself. And so they're learning new tricks. One of my favorite coworkers, you know, he is learning something new every week and really putting it to good use. But like he said, it's taking me hours to get to that point. So I think it just depends on who you are, the subject you teach. My math teachers that I work with, I feel like their struggles are similar to what they did in the classroom, but now they're trying to teach from a whiteboard that's set up at home or do examples on an iPad with a stylist, and it's just not the same. It's just different. So those things are definitely more time consuming and different. And then also I have to add in that many of us teachers are at home with our own children.
I was just going to mention that.
My son just came in and needed help on the app he's working on for his class. And it's, you get those interruptions, but I do feel like my students get a kick out of them walking in on the Zoom meeting or interrupting a video. And, you know, it makes it real. We're all real people with lots going on in our lives and big concerns. So
tell me about the importance of communication right now.
Oh, I think I've communicated more with parents and students in the last 5 weeks than I maybe did all semester. A lot of it is because it's new. They have questions and concerns. Are they doing it right? Is this what I should be doing? I think also there's those kids and parents missing. We put work out there, put information out there, and don't receive anything back. So, you know, after the first 2 weeks, I cold called, I emailed. Like I said, Google Hangouts, I was chatting with students online just to kind of motivate them and say, hey, this is not going away. We're not going back to school anytime soon. You need to do your work. You need to get online. You need to come to Zoom. You need to do these things. And so I think that kind of communication is what has consumed me the most. So I think it's great because we see this new involvement in education from parents and students that maybe wasn't there before. But then there's the other side of it. Are we losing day-to-day communication that we had with some of those kids that struggled in the first place? And so it puts it on our shoulders as teachers to amp it up and get out there and communicate and make those connections.
I've seen a lot of great photos and videos on social media from all across the state. Is there one thing that has really caught your attention that's happened in Watford City? Something that's amazing or something that's really brought a smile to your face?
Yeah, there's so many things that I'm proud of with our community. It is frustrating. It's trying. And I think, you know, whether you turn on the media or you get on social media or just even reading your emails, things can be so negative. So it's those positive, uplifting stories that I enjoy. Our elementary staff, one of the things that I think was really neat, they put to use the elementary aides, and they literally called every parent and just checked in and said, hey, how's it going? Are you stressed out? Is there anything we can do more to support you? Do you have questions? And I just thought that was really a neat use of their time, because I think a lot of parents out there are kind of feeling lonely with this idea of homeschooling, e-learning, you know, are we doing it right? And kids and parents get frustrated. So I think just that extra emotional support that was lent by our district was really cool. I just hope parents are, you know, supportive of the school district and what we're trying to do. And don't give up on your kid. Don't give up on this educational process. If you got to cut it back a little bit so that everybody stays sane in the house, fine, but don't quit, because it's really important work and kids need this right now, because being at home and, you know, not being able to go places and do the regular things that they do in the spring, it's important to have activities that keep their brains moving forward.
Well, if nothing else comes from this, I hope that more respect and appreciation for the job our educators do day in and day out is one thing that does emerge. I think as parents, we can all salute all of you for the work that you do, given the last several weeks.
Yeah. It's definitely, I think, changed our cultural views a little bit on teachers and education. It really put us out there. You know, a lot of us go into our classroom, shut the door, and if kids go home and tell their parents, great, but we don't expect that and we don't foresee that. And so now we're sitting online in the living rooms of every kid across the state. And I think it just goes to show what amazing professionals we have in the teaching field.
If you had a crystal ball, Amy, what do you think a year or 5 years from now, some takeaways will be from this time? I know it's so hard to ask that question when we're right in the middle of it, but any thoughts on any perspective you've had 10 or 15 seconds to think about?
Well, I guess I would hope that, you know, like we just discussed, there's this new appreciation for traditional learning that takes place in the classroom. I've had kids that I never thought I'd hear him say, man, I miss school. I miss my teachers. I miss my friends. You know, I just think this isolation hopefully will give us a bigger appreciation of what we do. But I also hope that, you know, this idea of innovating new ways to teach kids in the classroom, that maybe blended learning won't be such a tough transition if districts choose to go to that and use that. And I do think we have a fair amount of kids that, wow, e-learning is something I can be successful at. And maybe if there's colleges out there or secondary education institutions that use a lot of e-learning, it makes it more achievable for those kids. So I really do hope that maybe everybody's finding at least one or two positives. And when we go back to normal, we don't forget about this experience.
Tom Gerhart, host of the Education Mindset podcast, in a discussion with Watford City Education Association President Amy Polivka. You can hear other podcasts on education topics at ndunited.org. Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by AARP North Dakota, providing caregiving resources, healthy living information, tips for families to avoid scams, and connecting with communities at fun events. They're creating real possibilities here in North Dakota. AARP.org/ND.
This is Dakota Daybook for May 13th. After the Spanish were probably falsely accused of sinking the USS Maine off the coast of Cuba on February 15, 1898, no North Dakota newspaper called for a retaliatory strike. But once the Spanish-American War was actually started, the papers responded with patriotic zeal. The 1st North Dakota Infantry quickly assembled in May that year, and by August 12th, they were in waterlogged trenches south of Manila. The following day, Spain surrendered their hold on the Philippines. The troops of the 1st North Dakota felt they'd fulfilled their duties, and they expected to be sent home. That turned out to be naive, as opportunists saw the victory as a chance to annex the Philippines for American interests. When the Filipinos realized their liberators had become dominators, their fight for independence shifted, and a tenacious insurgency took root. The 1st North Dakota Infantry was now fighting the people they'd liberated. They weren't happy about it. In fact, the subsequent quagmire would lead many North Dakotans to become isolationist years later during World War I. North Dakota Governor Joseph Devine pressured the War Department to send North Dakota boys back to their families, but politics kept that from happening. The volunteers were far beyond mere disenchantment. In his diary entry of February 7, 1899, soldier John Rusiter wrote that they'd been given orders to burn every house where there was evidence of occupation by insurgents, as well as permission to shoot any insurgent who resisted being searched. Looting, burning, and intimidation of Filipinos, insurgents or civilians, escalated. By April 1899, both sides were engaged in brutal guerrilla warfare, and slowly public sentiment turned against the war. By the time the war was finally ended in 1902, 4,234 Americans were dead, and an estimated 20,000 Filipino soldiers. But as in so many wars, the true casualties were the civilians. Estimates of Filipino civilian deaths ranging from 200,000 to 500,000. Today's Dakota Daybook was written by Mary Helm. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
It's common for women to worry during pregnancy about their own health and the health of their baby. Counselors are now seeing anxiety levels rising.
They're crying, they're sad, they're confused, they are having trouble sleeping, they're not eating the right things.
Expectant mothers trying to cope with stress, anxiety, and depression during the pandemic on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. Remember, you can always hear our show stream at prairiepublic.org as we broadcast. And after the broadcast, you can listen to it as an archive, again, at prairiepublic.org. Thursday on our show, a slogan for the pandemic we're enduring might be, "We're all in this together," but that does not necessarily make it easy to feel empathy for friends or family or strangers. We'll hear self-care coach Randy Kay offer some advice about empathy fatigue on our show tomorrow. And root seller Sue Balcom will join us for another Main Street Eats to talk about homemade egg noodles. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.